This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
Officials say this happened overnight. Vandals defaced signage on the fence around the development known as the Pride, which is under construction.
That sound from WCVB News covering the vandalism at the Pride, an upcoming housing development in Hyde Park for LGBTQ seniors. Developers broke ground last month, and the first residents are scheduled to arrive in the fall of 2023. The vandals threatened violence in graffiti over the weekend if the development went forward. Gretchen Van Ness is the executive director of the nonprofit that's building the Pride. She was here on Radio Boston just over a month ago talking about her optimism for this new crop of housing.
This is very much a continuation of Stonewall. This is revolutionary in the senior housing and affordable housing world, and we can't wait to take this revolution bigger and broader and have Pride 2, Pride 3, Pride 4, you name it.
So what now? Gretchen is back with us to talk about this troubling incident. Gretchen, welcome back, and I'm sorry.
Thank you, Tiziana. Thank you for having us back today to talk about what happened yesterday and where we go from here. So I'm really happy to be here. Sad about the circumstances, though.
You know, you just mentioned being sad. What about that optimism that we heard from you just a month ago? Did yesterday's, or the, excuse me, the weekend's events shake that?
You know, I got up yesterday morning and started getting messages from my neighbors who had walked their dogs by the building and seen this horrible graffiti. And I was just, my heart sank. And I got in the car and drove over to the Pride. And I thought, okay, you know, there's a couple signs here. This isn't too bad. But then as I went around the block, it was every single sign that we had put up for our historic groundbreaking. And the words were just cruel and frightening, threatening to burn our building down, threatening to kill us. And I thought, I've never seen anything so horrible. And I was dismayed, angry, shocked. But then we called on the community to come out and stand with us. And by 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon, over 100 people joined us in front of the Pride to stand out against this hate, to stand with us shoulder to shoulder as we're building this community. And at the end of our event, people took their signs of welcoming and inclusion and love and covered up the hate signs with all of their beautiful handmade signs. So I have to say, at the end of the day yesterday, I felt so embraced by our community, so empowered by what we had seen and the people who stood with us, from our mayor to our district city councilor to our state reps from across the state, that my optimism is not at all compromised today. It's continues to be an amazing experience. And we know that when you make progress, when you are the first, you will be attacked. So that's where we are. So we will continue to make progress, and we are very courageous, and we will continue to be the first.
Do you feel safe today, Gretchen, as the developer of the Pride? Do you feel safe going forward?
Yes. Yes, I feel safe because of how the city has responded. The mayor stood with us yesterday. The chief of equity and inclusion called this morning to say that they are watching out for us. The Age Strong Commission stood with us. Our elected officials stood with us. But most importantly, our neighbors stood with us. So whoever those cowards were who defaced our signs and threatened us, we outnumbered them by hundreds between our groundbreaking and all of the neighbors who stood with us yesterday. So I feel very safe in this community, and I feel very safe saying to our future residents, the LGBTQ elders, and everyone else who wants to be part of the Pride community, that you are welcome here and you will be safe here. I will be your neighbor here, and you have people who will fight for you and stand for you.
Let's talk about the perpetrators. Gretchen, what do we know right now about who might have done this?
We don't know much. We immediately filed a police report. The police civil rights division is going to be investigating. Deputies were out yesterday with us. They walked through the building with us before we had our event to make sure the whole site was safe, to invite people to come and stand with us. And so we know that the investigation is happening. They've already spoken to the neighbors all around the building to see if anybody has video. From what I understand, there isn't any video that shows who did this. But we know that this is a grown-up because every single word was spelled properly. Someone took the time to barely make their message of hate and intolerance very clear. But we also know that this is not the community that Hyde Park has always been. As we've been talking about this project for years, we've been working with our neighbors of the former Barton Rogers School, the community groups, the neighborhood associations, everybody who will be impacted by this new community forming at the Pride. And so they know who we are. They know what we have planned, and they have welcomed us and supported us.
Sorry, there's a few more questions I want to make sure to get to. Sorry for jumping in on you there. So do I understand that you are satisfied right now with the response of the police department?
Yes, the police in the city of Boston are taking this very seriously, and we really, really appreciate that support.
Okay, and I know you've had responses from Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, city councilors. We have a bit of tape from City Councilor Ricardo Arroyo here, so let's hear that.
There's no place for this kind of hate and this kind of intolerance, and I am hopeful that we ascertain who was involved in this and that they are held responsible for that. But for the community at large, I want them to know that they are loved, that there are people in the community that will support them and will stand up for them, and will continuously do so in the face of threats like these.
What do you need from the city proper in the coming days, Gretchen?
To continue to say out loud and as boldly as every one of our elected officials have said that we are welcoming of the LGBTQ community in Boston. The LGBTQ community is part of Boston, part of our history, part of our future, and that we need to have a place where our elders are safe and welcomed. And the hardest part about this attack is that this is the community. These are the elders who grew up before there was any kind of legal protections for our community that we have right now. So these are the folks that experienced this when they were young as teenagers and tossed out of their family and lost their jobs or lost their homes. So it's particularly horrible that it's a community of LGBTQ elders that has been attacked and threatened. But we know that this is not who Boston wants. And we know that we are safe here.
We're talking with Gretchen Van Ness, who's the executive director of the nonprofit that's building the Pride, which experienced vandalism and graffiti over the weekend. Gretchen, are you worried that this is going to dissuade potential residents from wanting to live in the Pride? You're slated for the first residence in 2023.
I hope not. And we will work very hard to not let that happen. It's tough to be the first. It always it makes you a target, but we are very confident that Hyde Park welcomes us, that Boston wants housing like this that's welcoming and safe for all, and that the Pride is not going to be the only one. We're looking forward to building more, as we mentioned before.
All right. Gretchen Van Ness is executive director of LGBTQ Senior Housing, which is developing the Pride housing development in Hyde Park. Joined us just a month ago in optimism for this construction. Gretchen, good luck, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you again, Tiziana, for your support, and we'll be back anytime to talk about what we're doing.
I know we'll talk again.
Thank you.
A young gunman shot and killed former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe last Friday with a homemade gun. The assassination, an event so rare in Japan, it's almost hard to describe, sent shockwaves around the world, and that includes here in Boston, where Abe had been engaged with the Boston Global Forum, and where we pride ourselves on our own gun laws, as Japan does. Former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis, who signed the Commonwealth's assault weapons ban into law in 1989, helped found the Boston Global Forum.
Well, it wasn't just me, obviously. We were a group of people here in the Boston area who were very interested in foreign policy. I was one of them, but there were many. And we decided that this would be a good way to involve the Boston community actively in international affairs and important issues.
And as part of that work, the BGF decided to honor one world leader every year with its World Leaders Award for Peace and Security. And that first award, Shinzo Abe, in 2015. Dukakis joined us on the line this morning to reflect on Abe's assassination, and he started by talking about that moment in 2015.
He was the first person that we decided to honor with our annual award for peace and security.
Did he engage then with the forum after that?
He did indeed. Became an important part of what we've been doing. And that makes his death even more tragic, because his willingness to be a part of what we were doing and to involve and engage and really become a major force internationally in the effort to build a peaceful world and a more stable world was really an important part of what got us going.
So, as you know, one of the more striking aspects of this assassination is the fact that it was with a gun. And gun deaths are incredibly rare in Japan. According to the New York Times, since 2017, there have been only 14 gun-related deaths in the entire country. And, you know, the shooter used a handmade shotgun.
Homemade gun. I mean, how do you make a gun? and to do that, and I don't want to be critical of the Japanese on this, but as you look at the pictures of him and what happened and the actual assassination, it was clear that there seemed to be no security people around him or alert. Maybe I'm being unfair about this, but he was very much, you know, kind of like Mike Dukakis going out to a town in Massachusetts and having a meeting.
So you would say that the kind of security you could see in the videos that we've seen of the assassination was kind of comparable to what you would have had going about your daily business as the governor of Massachusetts?
I never had security.
Well, there you go. So even more than you had.
Not until I ran for the presidency. And then at some point, I think I was the last candidate for the presidency to say yes. But toward the end of the primary, I think it was, I finally said, okay. I never liked it. I loved the freedom that I had as governor of Massachusetts and my ability to go where I wanted to go and ride the T and do whatever I wanted to do.
Do you think that would be the case today? I'm mindful, for example, we talked about 14 gun-related deaths in Japan since 17. In 2020 alone, there were 19,000 firearm homicides in the U.S. Do you think if you were governor today, you could feel comfortable being as unfettered as you were then?
In Boston, yes, because we happen to have the lowest homicide rate in America, with the possible exception of Honolulu. And I don't know that enough people in Massachusetts understand this. I think during the first 6 months of this year, we've had a total of 7 homicides. Compare that with what's happening in the rest of the country. How come we're experiencing that here? Well, it has a lot to do with, frankly, terrific, well-trained police officers who have been part of a community policing program for years in this state. And even then, I don't think enough Massachusetts people really know just how fortunate we are and how important it is that we continue that and continue to have excellent police forces and police officers.
And I know that you're proud in terms of your leadership here in Massachusetts on guns. For example, you signed an assault weapon ban as governor in 1989. Why do you think our laws, our gun laws, and I'm sure you know where I'm going with this next, but why do you think our gun laws work so well in Massachusetts?
Because we have excellent, highly trained police officers who believe in community policing, in this sense that there's real respect between the communities and their police. And I think that's true almost across the state in virtually every community.
Even though we saw those protests, for example, in 2020, Governor, after the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis?
Well, that's true, but we never lost that edge here. We never lost this commitment to what I've referred to as community policing.
So you credit community policing with the level of gun safety that we have here.
No question.
Well, it makes me want to ask you. So, of course, the Supreme Court strikes down a New York State law that requires gun owners to show proper cause in order to be allowed to carry a handgun outside the home. In Massachusetts, it was the case that police chiefs required a good reason to issue a permit for a handgun in cities and towns around Massachusetts. The result of the Supreme Court ruling last Friday, Maura Healey, Attorney General, instructs police chiefs in the state that they can no longer require an applicant to show good reason. Are you worried that, you emphasize community policing, but given the ruling of the Supreme Court, are you worried about safety because of the effect on Massachusetts' current sort of regime around gun ownership?
Very much so. That's a terrible decision. I don't know what these 6 judges are thinking about. And by the way, they ought to read the Second Amendment a lot more carefully, apparently, than they have. Because the Second Amendment does not give one a right to walk around with a gun. There's language in there involving a well-regulated militia. What do they think that meant?
Governor, what do you think a well-regulated militia meant?
I think it, well, essentially, in modern terms, the National Guard. But, that was in 1776, for heaven's sake. You know, we're talking about AK-15s, we're talking about assault weapons, we're talking about gun magazines with dozens and dozens of bullets. I mean, aren't they aware of this? And why would six of these folks, I don't care who they are, where they come from, why would they ever hand down this decision? It's just shocking.
So what, if anything, should the legislature or the governor here do now in response, Governor Dukakis?
Well, they're working at it and doing the best they can to find their way through this terrible decision. So we'll just have to do everything we can to make it possible for us to continue to maintain what is, at least in the United States, an extraordinary record.
Former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis, I want to thank you for joining us today. Thanks.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Stay with us. There is more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Activists say it's a hidden problem, sexual misconduct against women who are incarcerated in Massachusetts. That's how the Prisoners Legal Services of Massachusetts is describing alleged sexual abuse against women inside state jails and prisons in a report obtained by WBUR. The report includes cisgender women in women's prisons and transgender women who are often housed with men. It claims the reported abuse is coming from prison staff and that it happens despite oversight and investigations from state officials. Deb Becker has been covering this for WBUR. She joins us now from the newsroom. And before we start, a note. This segment deals with sexual assault, and some listeners may find the content difficult. Deb, welcome back.
Thank you.
So, Deb, the top line here is startling. 86% of women interviewed in this report said they had either experienced or witnessed sexual harassment, sexual violence while in custody. What kind of behavior are we talking about here?
Right. The report interviewed 22 women who either had been or currently were at the time of the survey incarcerated in Massachusetts, and 19 of them said they had witnessed or experienced sexual misconduct by correctional staff. The alleged behavior included harassment, abusive strip searches, sexual relationships with staff in exchange for material gifts, and sexual violence. And all of the women interviewed, and there were some surveyed as well, asked to remain anonymous because they were concerned about potential retaliation.
That feels telling, Deb.
Yes, yes. And Prisoners Legal Services said that the reason that it felt compelled to do this report was because so many women wanted to be anonymous, and it isn't something they could litigate based on unnamed defendants. So they did a research report and issued this.
So, of course, Deb, one is struck by the power and balance. You've got, corrections officers who can strip search women. They have control over if and when inmates get called, can call their families. You know, there's a lot of control over life. You actually spoke to some women who weren't involved in the report. What did they tell you about that?
Well, I spoke with some women who've been released, and when I asked them about their experiences in custody in Massachusetts, many of them said that a lot of what they witnessed was harassment or relationships between correctional staff and incarcerated women, where women would often receive gifts in exchange for sexual favors. One woman I spoke with who did not want to be named because she was concerned about potential harassment said that the women incarcerated would often talk about these relationships, and this is what she saw.
She would get lingerie. I witnessed all that. Lingerie, gum, makeup, little things when they came in with food, and they would bless the girls with food that they brought in.
And this woman was incarcerated at MCI Framingham, the prison for women in Massachusetts, for 5 years. She left in 2020. And I also asked the women, well, why don't women come forward? Why don't they say something? And I'd like to play you a bit of tape from Jasmine Borges. She's now with the Mass Bail Fund. She was in prison for 12 years. And she said oftentimes, if women did try to report misconduct, they would have various things taken away or be further harassed. This is what she said.
They didn't get the jobs that they wanted. They couldn't visit with their children. They were locked in their rooms. They were sent to solitary confinement, depending on the allegation. So when you see all of that, it's just like, just shut up, bear, and grit your teeth and keep going.
So, Deb, you've covered incarceration of all kinds in Massachusetts for a long time. I have a lot more specific questions for you, but just listening to those two cuts from these women, does it track with your experiences in the past in covering our prisons and jails?
I think I've heard an awful lot about behavior inside correctional facilities, questionable behavior, and of course, I've covered lawsuits regarding abusive behavior alleged by staff in correctional facilities. So we have heard things like this in the past.
And Deb, is it correct that women in jail or prison have disproportionately more experience with trauma and sexual violence prior to entering jail? And if that's true, what are the implications for this then?
Right. Well, several national studies show that a significant number of incarcerated women, more so than incarcerated men, have a history of both trauma and mental illness. The nonprofit group, The Sentencing Project, did a national survey of people serving life without parole sentences for crimes that the state prosecuted them for when they were children. And that survey found that 80% of the women involved experienced physical abuse and 77% experienced sexual abuse. So I think the implications for this report, I mean, I think many women, because of their histories, may be desensitized to sexual misconduct in a way and just think it's part of life. And I think that what the report suggests is that the correctional system does not really rehabilitate these very vulnerable women. So more needs to be done both while they're in custody and to help them reenter.
What about, you know, protections in the law? For example, I know there's an act called the Prison Rape Elimination Act. Are things just not being enforced? Do we not have the right laws in place?
Well, I think that act does require the state to monitor allegations of sexual misconduct and issue annual reports, which the state does. And in the Massachusetts Department of Corrections 2021 report, which we should say includes allegations from both incarcerated men and women, there were 100 reports of alleged violations in 2021. 49 of those involved staff, so sexual misconduct involving staff, allegedly. And of those, though, jail and prison investigators determined that only 3 of the 49 alleged against staff were likely to have occurred. And the state does note that this low rate of documenting these allegations is an issue.
Has the state said anything about this report, Deb?
A spokesperson for the Massachusetts Department of Corrections said that the agency hasn't seen the report, but says the department does not tolerate any form of sexual abuse or harassment. And the department also says that any investigations into these types of allegations are done professionally and confidentially.
We're talking to WBUR reporter Deborah Becker about a new report finding prevalence of sexual assault and sexual violence in Massachusetts prisons and jails. Deb, the report itself called for more independent oversight. Is there likely anything that will make a difference?
Well, I think oversight, I believe it always helps. I don't know how likely it is. There was legislation in 2020 for more oversight of how jails and prisons were handling the pandemic that was stalled for several months. So I think some of the other recommendations in this report, such as improving reentry programs for women and investing more in community resources to help prevent crime and support families, those would likely make a difference, I think.
Anything that surprised you here, Deb?
Well, you know, the stories from the women interviewed by PLS researchers are very disturbing. And this is a difficult issue. There's no real proof often of sexual misconduct. That's why it remains hidden. And there's also stigma against the women here. They're charged or convicted of crimes. So many of them also worry that they won't be believed if they come forward. So I think it's an issue that correctional facilities around the country really are dealing with, and it's incredibly tough.
So before we let you go, I'm going to pivot to another story you've been following for a long time. You know, this is a From the Newsroom, and I think often our listeners may not understand the incredible gamut of things you are keeping track of as Deb Becker at any given time. So you've covered the decade-old story of evidence tampering at two drug labs. Ultimately, both Annie Ducan and Sonia Farrick received prison time for that. You're now covering the latest development in that. What's happening now?
Yeah. So in the latest development in the case of Sonia Farrick, three former prosecutors are accused of withholding potentially exculpatory evidence. This has been going on for quite some time. There were hearings about potential sanctions, and they face sanctions from the Board of Bar Overseers, or the BBO, which handles complaints against lawyers in Massachusetts. And the BBO just last week recommended disbarment, the most severe sanction possible for one of the former assistant attorneys general, Ann Kaczmarek. And this is the first time that the BBO has recommended that a prosecutor be disbarred for withholding potentially exculpatory evidence. And we should explain, the board said that Ann Kaczmarek withheld documents showing that Sonia Farrick's drug use went on longer than the attorney general's office had claimed. So therefore, more criminal cases were potentially compromised than the AG let on. And we should note that this was under former Attorney General Martha Coakley. And as for the other two former prosecutors, the BBO last week recommended a 1 year and 1 day license suspension for Chris Foster and a 3 month suspension for former Assistant Attorney General John Verner.
And to clarify, Ducan was the one who served, was incarcerated for the evidence tampering. Farrick was convicted of stealing and using drugs that she was supposed to be testing. Is the story over now, Deb? It's been a decade, or is there more to come?
No. The State Supreme Judicial Court will now determine the final sanction against these three former prosecutors. That's one avenue. Also, a judge has approved a settlement for 31,000 people who have had their cases dismissed. It's a $14 million settlement that was just approved. And this fall, efforts will be made to start distributing some of those settlement monies, which are to be used to reimburse people for court costs related to their now vacated criminal convictions. And there's also a civil suit pending against Ann Kaczmarek for a wrongful conviction, an alleged wrongful conviction in this case. So there, it's still happening.
Lots going on. All right, Deborah Becker is senior correspondent here at WBUR. We will keep you busy. Thank you so much, Deb.
You're welcome.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead. This is Radio Boston. It is the winter of 1969. Provincetown police are deep in the woods of nearby Truro. Through the snow and ice, they're looking for clues. Two women from Providence, Rhode Island, are missing. A baby blue Volkswagen Beetle believed to belong to one of them has been found abandoned nearby. In the process of investigating the area, they find two bodies. But they aren't the two women they were looking for. And a warning, this subject matter is gruesome. Listener discretion advised.
The age of the decomposed bodies may go back beyond 6 months, 8 months, 9 months. We don't know what took place during that time, and there are at least 2,000 or 3,000 missing females in the United States, and we don't know how many may be buried in the Truro woods.
That's then Bristol County District Attorney Edmund Denise at a press conference March 1969, talking about the discovery. Sound is from the Associated Press. The police would go on to find the bodies of Patricia Walsh and Marianne Wysocki, the bodies they were looking for in that same section of the woods roughly a month later, alongside the bodies of Sidney Monson and Susan Perry. That made four murders. The women appeared to have been sexually assaulted, their bodies dismembered, and buried in numerous holes in the ground. All four would eventually be tied to a local man named Anton Tony Costa, year-round resident of Provincetown. Known by many as a charismatic transient, a hippie, a drug user, a drug dealer, Costa would eventually be tried and convicted of the murder of Patricia Walsh and Marianne Wysocki. He was sentenced to life, but would only serve a few years before reportedly dying by suicide behind bars. Legendary photojournalist Stanley Forman covered the murders for the Boston Herald American, and we sat down with him recently to discuss his coverage of the case. We started by asking him to talk about the day he visited the site where the bodies were found.
I knew nothing about Truro and very little about Provincetown. You know, that was a place you visited. You took a boat and you got off there. And as I drove down with Eddie Corsetti, I knew more about the story. And the chief of police, it was a different time. He took us into the woods, into the area, actually showed us the trees where the women were tied and, cannibalized.
What was it like to stare at those trees, and what kind of image did you think you were going to make?
Well, I don't think, you know, back then I was, 22 years old, 23 years old. I don't think that I was bothered by the incident itself at the time. I was there to do a non-biased story, show everything, talk to people, get pictures to go in the newspaper to go with Eddie's story. And I made a picture in the woods and, you know, show trees and that type of thing with the chief of police and have him in the picture. It was a different time, different thoughts. I saved the negatives of Anton Costa coming out of the courthouse, but I don't have any of the other negatives. So I don't remember what kind of pictures I made. The key thing for us was Anton and his wife, Avis.
So you mentioned your well-known photograph of Anton Costa, who's Tony Costa, coming out of the courthouse. And, of course, that's a big piece of the story here is Tony Costa. So how long was it between your visit to those woods in Truro, North Truro, and when you first heard about Tony Costa?
I still remember being down there for 3 days. If we spoke to the police chief after he was captured, we were down there doing the story about his arraignment, I'm sure.
Was he what you imagined when you saw him?
No, he didn't fit the bill at all. I mean, here was this, you look at the picture, he's a handsome guy. I think he had a car. I have to go look. I'm not going to go look at the picture, but I'm pretty sure he had a jacket and a tie. And, of course, they might have let him put on good clothes, not like now. If they were taken into custody, they'd be most likely be in prison garb. But this handsome guy came out, big smile, gave his wife a big smile. He didn't know she was going to be there. They looked at each other and, hi, honey.
It's really quite strange. She's smiling at him like it's their front porch and he's bringing out lemonade.
Yes. I mean, did she not believe that he did that? You know, I don't remember her reaction. I don't think she ever said, I know he did it. And even around town, I think it was a surprise. He did not fit the bill.
You described his outfit accurately from the picture. He was dressed up, and you said, did she not think he did it? At the time, did people think he did it? Did you think he did it at that time?
Well, I didn't know enough about him. I do. Here's the one thing I remember. That when people we talked to, he was a jack of all trades and a master of none.
What does that mean?
Well, that means he could do a little bit of everything, but he couldn't do anything very well.
And was that, and my understanding is you'd heard a lot of people call him that was kind of a reputation of his.
Yeah, I remember the Ed Corsetti using that term that he got from other people.
You have seen incredible things and you have photographed incredible things. You know, many of our listeners will remember the photo you took of the white man with the American flag and the flagpole attacking the black man in Boston during passing.
Ted Landsmark, the soiling of old glory.
Yeah. Is there anything about the photos you took and the reporting that you were a part of with Tony Costa and these serial killings in Cape Cod that really stays with you today?
Just the fact he came out smiling out of the courthouse. That's why I saved those negatives. I mean, he's a murderer. I mean, he knew it. I was told recently, I didn't read the book because I knew someone wanted to talk to me about it. I'm sure Casey's got all the detail, but they tell me in his memoirs or something in prison before he killed himself that he had admitted to doing it. What was he, 28 years old? 29?
He was in his 20s.
Yeah. And as I say, you look at this guy and say, boy, he's got the whole world in front of him. and there it is.
Why didn't you read the book?
I'd like to keep my own memories of it. I didn't want to know that much.
And is there anything in particular besides that moment, that smile, that you want to hold on to as a memory?
The fact that the chief of police brought us into the woods and showed us where they were. And you know, I know as much as I want to know about Tony Costa.
That was Stanley Forman, Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer and photojournalist. We did read the book. Some of Forman's photos, including that well-known one of Tony Costa leaving the courthouse during his trial, are included in a new book called Helltown, The Untold Story of a Serial Killer on Cape Cod. It's what made us want to speak with Forman. So in it, author and investigative journalist and Cape Cod native Casey Sherman explores Costa's killing spree as well as the culture at the time of those atrocities. Sherman is here in Studio 2, joins us. Casey Sherman, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Holy cow, what a story.
What a story.
Yes. So let me just start with reactions from you from what you just heard from Stanley Forman.
Sure. Well, Stanley and I go back a long way. We were colleagues in television news for some time, and Stanley's got, you know, vivid memories of an incredible career in Boston. And I will say that I've covered 20 to 30 homicides in my career, and I've never seen anything as brutal as this. I don't think there's been a more vicious serial killer since Jack the Ripper stalked the women of East London back in the 1880s. That's how graphic and gruesome these crimes were.
All right, so I want to walk a balance here. It's 11 a.m. on a weekday morning. I don't want to get
I understand.
And we did lay out the basics of the story, as you heard, before we played our conversation with Stanley Forman. Anything else about the story? Let's just round out the story for listeners who have not yet read the book.
Sure. Well, you know, the story is it's a forgotten serial murder case on Cape Cod in 1969. A young, charismatic, hippie-like messiah was luring these beautiful, smart young women into dark areas in the woods of Truro and killing them in the most gruesome ways. And you mentioned, obviously, you know, it's morning here, and I understand that the subject matter is sensitive. And I've had to live with the autopsy photos and the crime scene reports and all the photos that I've had to, you know, absorb over time. And it's still very difficult for me to even talk about. But, you know, given the fact that I had to write this book and tell it in a unique way through the prism of two writers that became darkly obsessed with the case, I thought, okay, I can do this.
So those two writers, Norman Mailer and Kurt Vonnegut, and I'm going to come to them in just a minute. I want to stay with the case because it's fascinating to me that you grew up on the Cape.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear about this story when you were a kid, and what did you hear?
Sure, I did, and it was told in passing almost as a joke. You know, Tony Costa had the nickname Tony Chop Chop on Cape Cod, and he was, you know, considered the boogeyman for all the little kids on Cape Cod. I was, in fact, you know, when I was born at Cape Cod Hospital the weekend that Tony Costa moved into that rooming house in Provincetown. And just a few days before Patricia Walsh and Marianne Wysocki came down for a weekend away and never made it home.
So that gives me goosebumps, especially knowing that you also have a relative who was a victim of the Boston Strangler.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, my 19-year-old Mary Sullivan was the youngest and final victim in that notorious 1960s murder spree. So in the course of my writing career, I'd gone down and taken that dark journey with a serial killer before. I wasn't willing to, you know, take another look at that. I didn't want to do it. There are other stories that I felt compelled to write. But during the height of the pandemic, I just wanted to get out of the house. So my brother and I took a drive into Provincetown, and we're driving down Commercial Street, which was completely abandoned. And we're talking about the ghosts, real and imagined, in Provincetown. And that ultimately led us to the topic of Tony Costa. And we joked around about it in my car. And then I went back to my writing office and I took a fresh look at this case. And I was shocked at just how disturbing it was.
So the case, as you write it in this just riveting book, was so much more than those almost cheesy stories that you heard.
Oh, of course. You know, and again, I mean, there's a lot of psychology with regard to this case as well.
Split personality.
Split personalities.
For Tony Costa?
Yeah. He, you know, they called it ego splitting at the time, where he had an alter ego that he could blame, you know, for these brutal crimes that he was committing. And he was really the epitome of a living Norman Bates from Hitchcock's Psycho. He was an amateur taxidermist. He had a love-hate relationship with his mother that he projected onto these, you know, young women whose only crime was kindness and compassion. and, you know, and letting their guard down for a very charming, charismatic man who had a very dark part of himself.
So we're speaking with Casey Sherman, who is the author of Helltown, which explores serial murders in 1968, 1969, Provincetown area, Truro area. Fascinating story. Casey, one of the things that really struck me about the book is that you do two things in the book. You introduce these living, breathing people who also become characters. These are the authors who become fascinated with the dark side.
Right.
And then you answer the question that I'm screaming all the way through the book, which is, why don't we know about this? So let's start with, I was just stunned. All of a sudden, Kurt Vonnegut and Norman Mailer walk into your book. So first, let's remind listeners who Kurt Vonnegut and Norman Mailer are.
Sure. Kurt Vonnegut and Norman Mailer are, you know, two of the iconic literary figures of the second half of the 20th century. Kurt Vonnegut wrote Slaughterhouse-Five, which became a declaration of the anti-war movement in Vietnam. Norman Mailer was a multi-Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and journalist himself, wrote The Executioner's Song and a litany of other titles. And it's interesting that these writers have been all but forgotten, you know, in kind of today's, you know, literary culture. So one of my, purposes of writing this book was to reintroduce these two giants who had a lot of darkness in themselves to the reading public.
So Vonnegut was living in Barnstable and finishing Slaughterhouse-Five.
Finishing Slaughterhouse. So Vonnegut,
I mean, what are the chances?
I know. He was he had spent 20 years living on Route 6A in Barnstable, and he was a commercial failure as a writer. He was writing science fiction. No one was paying attention to his work, and he was, you know, really struggling with his personal memoir, which was a fictionalized account of his life as a POW in Dresden in the 1940s during World War II.
Which was also brutal. Brutal.
A brutal moment in world history. And, you know, Vonnegut survives. Little does he know that he's going to encounter, you know, near equal brutality, at least singular, you know, in his backyard when he comes home. And then you've got Norman Mailer, who, again, is a brilliant guy, but very dark. People don't remember that Norman had, nearly killed his second wife, Adele, with a penknife during a dinner party in 1960. And both become, as I said, darkly obsessed with this murder case that's starting to unfold in their own backyard.
So, okay, so I'm going to push on you a little bit on this part, because sure. this is a nonfiction book.
Yeah.
As you're exploring the internal monologues of Vonnegut and Mailer, and neither of them look good, but in your book, man, does Vonnegut look bad. A violent, abusive, incompassionate, unempathetic person. Some of that is fictionalized. So how did you feel that you had the right to tell that story that way,
sure,
of these two authors?
Because, you know, quite frankly, I was inspired by their writing to take a different approach to this book. I've written 15, you know, best-selling books, and most of them have been true crime. And this is the first time that I've sprinkled in some fictional storytelling to provide that connective tissue for the reader. And everything that's in either Kurt's mind or Norman's mind had been harvested from 1,000 different interviews that they had given over their time. And I would say that, you know, Kurt is struggling here. You know, is he a brutal character in the book? He's got the darkness in him, but he's also struggling to raise not only his family, but the family of his dead sister. He is not coming to grips with his own post-traumatic stress from World War II. And in the afterword of the book, you know, I repurpose a letter that Kurt had written to my own father in 1973. And it was a critique. My father sent him a query letter. He was an unknown graphic artist, my dad, and wanted to get a shot at illustrating some of Kurt's books. And Kurt wrote him back at the height of Kurt's career and said, "You can't work out of your mailbox in Hyannis, Massachusetts. You have to go to New York." And it was a pretty strong letter to my dad. My dad didn't take it well. My family didn't take it well. That letter sat in a drawer for decades until I began to explore Kurt's past. And I thought, this letter isn't a mean letter to my dad. It's a beautiful letter. Kurt's writing a letter to his younger self saying, you need to get off Cape Cod if you want to be successful. So now that letter is actually framed and hanging in my office. I thought it was a really beautiful note from a guy at the height of his powers.
Did you ever feel, you've talked about the autopsy photos, you were born in a hospital when Costa's moving into that rooming house. You have a dark tie to the Boston Strangler case. As you were going through this, did you ever fear you were going to slide into a little bit of an abyss with the weight of everything that your life is tied to?
I did actually slide into that abyss, and my wife had to pull me out of it because, you know, I was living with those images for quite some time. And as I said, I've been to, you know, crime scenes and watched autopsies being performed live, but I can't imagine something like this. This is, you know, these women, these victims look like they'd been attacked by a shark. That's how vicious the attacks on these women were. And it just, you know, what I wanted to do also in Helltown was, you know, really focus on the memories of these young women, that they weren't just statistics. They weren't just victim number one through four. They're real people. And as I said, their only crime was just being kind to a stranger or somebody that they knew. And Tony Costa took complete advantage of it in brutal ways. And, you know, there are people around Costa that I think protected him, much like, you know, Charles Manson had his family. Costa had his disciples as well. And many of them are still living in Provincetown today.
So that brings us to this last part, which is that you then tell us why we don't know this story. And it's basically, wait for it, an intersection of Chappaquiddick and Charles Manson.
1969 is a year of reckoning in American history. And I look at it very similar to what we're dealing with in 2002. You know, I mean, you know,
2022.
Thank you. There's a lot of darkness out there. You know, hope is all but gone. You know, in 1969, it was right after the assassinations of Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King. You've got an unwinnable war in Vietnam. You've got the DNC bloody protest in Chicago. You've got the moon landing. You've got Ted Kennedy in Chappaquiddick. And somehow all of the characters, or at least the main characters in Helltown, all are involved, you know, either directly or by, you know, by proxy to these major political shifts in America.
And so that also led to distraction. For example, the DA, Denise,
yep,
thought this was going to kind of make his career. Everybody's going to pay attention to the serial killer trial, but then Manson.
Then Manson comes around, and Ed Denise exaggerated the murders to the press, and you didn't have to exaggerate one, you know, iota of what Tony Costa did to these women. But he, you know, he called Tony Costa a cannibal and all these things that Tony Costa actually didn't do. But then Manson comes along and just takes all the oxygen out of the room because of not only who he was, but the people that he had targeted. Sharon Tate, you know, I mean, it was the L.A. Hollywood culture that people still talk about to this day. And it just took Tony Costa right off the front pages.
All right. So having been through the book, thumping good read, right?
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Also, a piece of history that I can't believe I'd never even heard of. When listeners read this book, when your audience reads this book, what do you want them to take from it?
Well, I want them, you know, to understand that, you know, you have to be aware of your surroundings. If you know, if you're a young man or a young woman, you always have to, you know, and I tell that to my own kids. You know, here was an unassuming serial killer that people just didn't look twice at. You had Stan Forman talk, you know, just about that earlier. So he didn't look like a killer, but he was one of the darkest figures in American history. And, you know, I tell people, imagine that Jack the Ripper was resurrected to stalk the women of Cape Cod. That's not fantasy. Mm. That actually happened in 1969.
And what are you working on now? Can you tell us?
Yeah, I'm working on an L.A. noirish story that takes place in 1958. It's the Lana Turner shooting of her boyfriend, Johnny Stompanato, with her 14-year-old daughter who allegedly pulled the trigger. So this is a cross-section of gangsterism and glamour in old Hollywood, and I look forward to jumping in.
I'll probably read it. All right. Thanks so much. Local author and investigative journalist Casey Sherman. The new book is Helltown, The Untold Story of a Serial Killer on Cape Cod. It's out tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Tuesday. Casey, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles with Maya Schwader. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Titus Faladoon is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for starting your week with us. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.